listening to The Radiator 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author Julia Alvarez, whose latest book is A Wedding in Haiti, The Story of a Friendship, published by Shannon Ravenel Books, which is an imprint of Algonquin. This interview is actually a co-production between The Radiator and RETN, the Regional Educational Technology Network, Channel 16 in Burlington. And you can watch the television broadcast of this interview on RETN's website, which is retn.org. Julia Alvarez was born in New York City. When she was 3 months old, her parents, both native Dominicans, decided to return to their homeland, preferring the dictatorship of Trujillo to the USA of the early 50s. Her father got involved in the underground movement, as he had before, and the family again had to leave the Dominican Republic for New York in 1960, 4 months before the founders of that movement, the Mirabel sisters, were brutally murdered by the dictatorship. And that's a story that Julia would later recount in her novel, In the Time of the Butterflies. In 1991, Julia Alvarez earned a tenure at Middlebury College and published her first novel, How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents. And at that point, she was 41 years old, with 20-plus years of writing behind her. She often mentions this fact to student writers who are discouraged at 19 when they don't have a book contract yet. Eventually, she gave up her tenured post at Middlebury to write full-time. She has since become a writer-in-residence at the college, advising students, teaching occasional courses, and giving readings. She also serves as the godmother, or madrina, to the school's Latino Students Organization Alianza, and says that that is her greatest honor. She has now spent more years in Vermont than she has anywhere else on the planet, and calls this place her true alma mater, the mother of her soul. Julia settled down with her compañero, Bill Eichner, on 11 acres in Vermont, which Bill farms, growing vegetables and greens and apples and potatoes and even Asian pears organically, haying the back pasture and planting so many berry-bearing trees and bushes that they now have enough birdsong around, Julia says, to keep her humble. Recently, Bill has added animals, cows, calves, rabbits, chickens. Julia says that as a vegetarian, it's an odd adventure helping raise somebody else's meat. But if you're going to be a carnivore or wear shoes or carry a handbag, this is the way to do it, conscionably, with affection and caring and abiding gratitude to the creatures who provide for us. About 11 years ago, Bill and Julia started a sustainable farm literacy center called Altagracia, where they grow organic shade-grown coffee. She wrote about the project and about the importance of sustainability in a modern green fable that she titled A Cafecito Story. The afterword by Bill Eichner tells all about their farm. Julia Alvarez has written 19 books, and her latest is A Wedding in Haiti, which we discussed on the set of RETN Channel 16 in Burlington last month. Welcome to Catalyst. Today's show is a cooperative effort between RETN and The Radiator, 105.9 FM in Burlington. I'm Shayla Shapiro, host of a Radiator program called Write the Book. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Julia Alvarez about her new book, A Wedding in Haiti, published by Algonquin. Julia Alvarez is the author of 19 books, including How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, In the Time of the Butterflies, Something to Declare, and A Cafecito Story. She's a writer-in-residence at Middlebury College, and she and her husband, the ophthalmologist Bill Eichner, established and now oversee Altagracia, an organic coffee farm and literacy arts center in Julia's homeland of the Dominican Republic. A Wedding in Haiti takes place between the Dominican Republic, the United States, and Haiti, where Julia and Bill traveled twice between 2009 and 2010. The first time they traveled there for a wedding, and the second time in support of Haitian friends following the earthquake of January 2010. So thank you so much for being here, Julia.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder if we can start by discussing a line from the book. You write, "Haiti is like a sister I've never gotten to know."
Well, we are two little countries on one island, and you'd think that we would know each other. You know, we're sharing a small landmass, But it's like many troubled borders, it's been a very difficult history between the two countries. And, you know, the going way back when the French, when the Haitian, the new Haitian nation were fighting the French and came over and occupied the Spanish side. And then later in 1937, when the dictator Trujillo ordered the murder of all Haitians living on the Dominican side of the border. And in the course of 9 days or so, anywhere, the figures vary wildly, anywhere between 4,000 and 40,000 Haitians were killed. And this year will be the 75th anniversary, and it's been, you know, one of those genocides never acknowledged, never fully faced, and it's, you know, the bad blood continues. Mm-hmm. So when I was growing up, I was told, you know, if I didn't get to sleep, if I didn't finish what was on my plate, the Haitian cuco was going to come and take me.
Oh, my.
And they would take me to Haiti where they ate little skinny Dominican girls. Go figure.
Oh, my.
But, you know, as what it did for me, I love stories even back then, is that it made me even more curious. I wanted to stay up and see what this fellow was like. But it is that ingrained in the culture, that mistrust of each other.
Right, the one and the other.
Right, right. And so, yeah, it's right there, right across the border, as close as going, I guess, you know, up to Canada from Santiago, where my parents are based, and I, you know, had never been there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got to know Haiti much better in recent years, partly in due to your friendship with a young man named Piti.
Right.
I'm wondering if you can read a little something from the book that introduces us, or just talk about and read about Piti.
Well, the first scene in the book is about meeting him and you know, a little exchange that happens, and then talking about a friendship began. Every trip I sought him out, brought him a shirt, a pair of jeans, a bag in which to cart his belongings back and forth on his periodic and dangerous crossings of the border. What I felt toward the boy was unaccountably maternal. Somewhere in Haiti, a mother had sent her young son to the wealthier neighbor country to help the impoverished family. Maybe this very moment she was praying that her boy be safe, earn good money, encounter kind people. Every time I spotted the grinning boy with worried eyes, I felt the pressure of that mother's prayer in my own eyes. Tears would spring up and a big feeling fill my heart. Who knows why we fall in love with people who are nothing to us. So, you know, this is a young Haitian that I meet because, as happens with a lot of the Mexican migrant workers who cross the border to try to earn a living at the wealthier neighbor country. Mm-hmm. We're two poor little countries on one island, but the Dominican Republic is a lot better off than Haiti. So there's a huge migration because it's the easiest one. There's also the migration to the United States, the migration to the capital, Port-au-Prince. Why so many families that weren't from the capital had family members there and lost someone with the earthquake, because that's right. The other site where there are some jobs. But many cross the border. And just as we say, you know, there's a film, A Day Without a Mexican, about what would happen if all the Mexicans were deported to the infrastructure in the United States. The same is true of the Dominican Republic, especially in agriculture, construction, service industries. So Piti had crossed the border to come work up in the coffee growing area. Uh-huh. And that's how we met him, because of the coffee. Well, first we met him on the road. And then later he came to work at the farm.
And how old was he when you first met him?
Well, I thought, Bill and I have had this ongoing argument until I saw the documentation. He was 17 when he crossed the border. We met him soon thereafter. But he looked 14.
Okay.
And that's why his nickname is Piti.
Is Piti.
Which is, in Creole, means the little one.
Right.
And he looked like he was 14 years old.
Yeah. Now, how long ago was that?
That was in 2001. So he's about 27 now.
Okay.
Yep.
And through the years, as you got to know him better, one of the things that happened was that you would talk about how you were someday going to come to his wedding.
Wow. I get in trouble through the storytelling. He was up at the farm one night, and when we're there, everybody comes because, you know, it's a kind of open table. Everybody's going to get a meal. And afterwards, we play music. He learned how to play a guitar that a volunteer brought down and started a band. Like every young kid in the world, he wants to be a rock star. So he would sing, and we would all sing along, and one night he just didn't want to sing. He seemed very down, and I knew he was homesick, and I said, Piti, you know, trying to cheer him up with a story, I said, Piti, I see your future. You're going to meet the love of your life, a beautiful young Haitian girl, and you're going to marry her and have a family. And he just looked at me like I was crazy, because where was he going to meet a nice Haitian girl in the mountains of the Dominican Republic in an all-male work crew?
Sure.
And so he just, you know, just shook his head. I said, no, Piti, it's going to happen. I see it. And you know what? I'm going to be the godmother of the wedding, and I'm going to be there. So, you know, you make this grand promise, and you forget it. 8 years later, fast forward, we get a call in Vermont saying, I'm getting married in a week. Madrina, godmother, are you coming?
Thanks for all the notice.
Yeah, except, well, I had a conference I was supposed to go to, all these things, you know, that I just said, Piti, I'm sorry, you had to give me more warning. I'm sorry, you know, can't be there, hang up, and it's the pebble in my shoe. You know, I started thinking, this kid, so many people have failed him, including the situation into which he was born. You know, life has failed him. Every kid should have some opportunity, and he hasn't. And are you going to be one on that list of the people who fails Piti? So, you know, people think, oh, you're so good. I go kicking and screaming into all my good deeds. I resist till the last minute. And I thought I've got to do it. So we decided, yep, we're going. And, you know, at that point, I just thought, you know, you cross the border, you pay a few fees. And I imagined the straight highway to a cathedral. I brought my summer wedding outfit that I wear to weddings, a long fluffy skirt and a little camisole. And that's, I thought, well, you know, the hard part was just deciding to go from
yes.
now on. It's easy.
One thing that I loved in the book that's along those same lines is you call him to get the address
right.
so that you can go to the wedding.
I know.
And he says, what's the exact? He says, an address, it's not possible that way.
Yes.
I loved that line, but I also wanted you to maybe talk a little bit about why is it not possible that way?
Well, you know, you Google, and it's not even on the Google map. You know, there are lines in the Google map where there are no roads because the last hurricane washed them out or because the infrastructure hasn't kept them up and there's been a landslide. And none of this, you know, do you know ahead of time. So you have to continually problem solve. And we had to, it was 12 hours going down and going over and then having to turn around and go, you know, that kind of a trip.
Sure.
Clear across to northwest Haiti, then fording a river where there was no bridge. And later when there was a rainstorm, it became a problem getting back. And then opening what was just a footpath through with a pickup, just driving on it, about 45 minutes to Charlie's house, then about a 30-minute drive to where the wedding was going to be, so we thought, but that's where you park the pickup, and you go 45 minutes hiking up and down a stony mountainside. And at first, when I heard what was ahead, I thought, well, I'm going to wear my hiking boot, what I had on, my hiking boots, my T-shirt, my jeans, and then I thought, the hell with that. You know, I've come to this wedding. I'm going to dress in style. So I don't know why I didn't break my neck because I had a long fluffy skirt, little sandal, heels.
Oh, my goodness.
Going up and down.
You didn't change the shoes even for the hike.
No, because, you know, they said, well, it's just, you know, that's the other thing. People live this way. It's no big deal to them.
It's just
a little ways. Well, a little ways became one of those flexible phrases that I learned to be aware of, but at that point I wasn't cautious about it. When they say it's just a little ways, it's not steep. Well, it was, At one point, I just took the sandals off and went barefoot. Yeah.
One of the things I really enjoyed about the book was reading about the generosity with which you were met by Piti's family and friends and townspeople. There's this one scene where, in order for you and your group to have beds, they all sleep on mats outside on the ground under the stars, but you didn't know it until the next morning.
Right.
So I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about the hospitality and the welcoming.
You know what? This is the phrase that came to mind as I kept hearing after the earthquake, this impoverished nation, the poorest nation in this hemisphere, this failed nation, this pariah state, Haiti, nothing works. What I kept thinking of is how come people don't know about how rich Haiti is in values that I think many of us in our first world countries have forgotten, in our race to success and progress and all those things. Mm. There were certain values that I kept thinking it behooves us to learn from Haiti, because we're going to need just those values to survive on a planet of slowly dwindling resources. How to live with nothing. Mm-hmm. They have no infrastructure. Mm-hmm. They have not everything. Talk about recycling. You don't need a program. Everything gets recycled. How to take care of each other. Mm-hmm. Solidarity. As you said, they had three beds on which 12 people slept. Talk about learning how to do the math, how to position everybody on a bed.
Yeah.
And when they offered the three of, our volunteer, Bill and myself, and a Dominican friend that had come along, when they offered us the three beds, I said, where are you going to sleep? They said, there's plenty of room. Well, I thought, they'd go to neighbors' houses or there was a back guest house. I didn't know. When I woke up and peeked outside, they had laid their mats under, as you say, under the stars, and that's where they were all sleeping.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, you have nothing, but you share what you have. And so when that earthquake happened, I thought, this is a Haiti, not to minimize the problems in Haiti, the poverty in Haiti, the disaster that the earthquake was, mm-hmm. but that there was a Haiti with a huge soul and certain values and just a richness of culture and oral tradition that nobody was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Haiti that I had experienced when I went to Piti's wedding.
Mm-hmm. So you went to the wedding, and then after the earthquake, you decided to go back.
Right, right.
In order to see, to bear witness to what had happened there, but also to see how he and his family were doing, to help him see how everybody was.
Right.
So how was the return?
Well, Piti and Eslina were already living in the Dominican
Republic. Eslina being his wife.
His wife,
yes.
And their little baby. And she, after the earthquake, they were beside themselves because they didn't know what had happened with their families. And Eslina got very ill.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no, doctor's visits. There were medications. She just wasn't getting better. And Piti was beside himself with worry. And finally he said, the only thing that's going to work is to go home. And he was right. And so we thought, well, we can just give them money and send them, they'll find their way across the border with smugglers, whatever. And we thought, well, we're the godparents of this couple. There are certain requirements with this.
Absolutely.
With this privilege.
Sure.
And so we decided we would go back with them. And it was quite a trip. Again, we were a little more prepared because we knew what we were in for to get to their house. But as you know, from the book, a huge rainstorm and we can't cross the river back once we're there.
That was an extraordinary story.
Yeah.
That whole thing with the truck,
right.
I just couldn't believe that was happening.
How we're going to get there, and there was a small earthquake. It just seemed like, oh my goodness,
Yeah.
And then we went down, of course, into Port-au-Prince, it was 6 months after the earthquake, but the tent cities and the devastation and just the experience of being there after, as one young Haitian woman said on a YouTube video that was made while the earthquake was going on, she said, it's the end of the world, it's the end of the world. And it did feel like a visit after the end of the world,
mm-hmm.
to a place where that had just collapsed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You went to Port-au-Prince.
Right.
during that trip. And there's a scene in the book where you recount being in a breakfast place, and you
right.
meet a gentleman who speaks English, Junior, you call him.
Right.
I loved this. He sort of assumed that you were aid workers or something, and you
right.
said, "We're really here just to see." And you said it with a little bit of conflict in your heart. And he said, "Well, it needs to be seen." And I loved that. I thought that was wonderful.
Yeah.
It made me think from a writer's perspective about the importance mm-hmm. of telling stories
yeah.
and sharing that with a larger audience. So I wonder if you can talk about that and your motivation for writing A Wedding in Haiti.
Well, you know, it was an amazing phrase when he said Haiti needs to be seen.
Mm.
And I thought, yeah, you know, there's so many lenses that we have in the way we see countries like Haiti,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the ways we see each other, because I think this is also a book about seeing. And, you know, people say, you know, you're writing about a wedding in Haiti and there's these huge problems, you know, gosh, you know. And I quote the little haiku by Isa, the Japanese poet, and he has a haiku where he says, "I look in the dragonfly's eye and I see the mountains over my shoulder."
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes it's through the little specific detail that you really see the bigger issues. And also the big problems that need to be solved, sometimes the way they're solved is, first of all, by seeing as accurately as you can, seeing with the eyes of love, seeing with compassion, and just one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
This is how it gets built. And so I didn't plan when I went to the wedding that this was going to... I had put aside my writing project to go on this trip, you know, grumbling that I was doing this. And I wasn't planning to write a book about it. And it stayed so much in my head after that first trip that every once in a while I was writing things out based on my journal, which was mostly just details jotted down without coherence, going back to it, thinking about it, talking with Bill about it. And I thought, maybe there's something here. And then the earthquake happens.
Mm.
And it was my way of sort of being with Haiti and the other Haiti than the disaster Haiti that I was hearing about, almost like lighting a little candle of hope, because there was also this Haiti, and I knew it was there.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it was there when I was watching some clip on television of this woman that was dug out of the rubble after 3 days. You know, she was all white with dust, mm-hmm. and things were broken, and you imagine that she had been terrified and that she was in pain. And they pulled her out, and she was singing.
Oh, yeah, right.
She was singing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, whoa, Haiti. You know, it's you're coming back when there's this resilience in the people.
Yeah.
And so it was an amazing moment. And that's when I said, I've got to tell this story.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, part of telling the story is also telling a little bit of your own story.
Right.
There's a line in the book that's about your husband. "Anything I come up with, Bill takes it and runs with it. It's how my writing an article about small endangered coffee farms morphed into our owning one," which
right.
is great. So I was wondering if you could describe the difference, if there is any, of writing about the family you're born with versus writing about the family that you choose.
Well, as you know from the book, mm-hmm. I do write about both.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I write about the family that we've chosen in getting involved with Piti and Esline and their little baby Luthi, who are now part of, you know,
right.
God children, part of our family. I write about my parents, elderly parents, and because there are many love stories. There's the obvious one about Piti and Esline, but there's
yeah.
the one of my parents and their love story and the serendipity of how they met
mm-hmm.
In 1947. In New York City, of all places, even though they came from the same small town in the Dominican Republic. So there's that story. And then the story of a mature, sometimes an immature, mature relationship between Bill and myself. So there's that love story as well. And, you know, I write moved by the story and where it takes me. And I think the difficulties are come later when I then think, you know, how are people going to respond to this, you know?
Right.
And Bill read everything along the way, and he's a, thank goodness, he's a very confident and big-hearted man. I said, well, what about, you know, the scenes where you sort of don't act very nice and they're in there, but then the scenes where I don't act very nice are in there too. He says, that's just being a human being.
Exactly.
And I'm just floored by that he's so ready to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
To be seen,
sure,
in all his complexity, because to see only the positive things is not to be seen. It's to be, you know, it's to be boxed in a little narrow, flat description, which isn't who you are.
Right.
And so, so the difficulties come later where I worry, you know, oh dear, you know, especially because this is nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I'm writing How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, even though there's many autobiographical elements, you know, family gives me a hard time. I said, but it's fiction.
Right, nobody knows what's real. Nobody knows for sure.
That didn't stop them from giving me a hard time. But at least I have that, you know, because it's true. You know, you've changed things and things are malleable and you fit what is needed in the story. But in nonfiction, there are certain fixed points.
Mm-hmm.
You're still making fictional choices. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, strategies,
right,
what to leave out, what to put in.
And how to reproduce a conversation in dialogue.
How to reproduce,
sure,
a conversation, you know, what angle, what, you know, all of those things. So, you know, I say that even the truth is the story we tell ourselves about what really happened. Because even history, depending on where you are experiencing,
mm-hmm,
it, you have a certain perspective and you're seeing it through your character.
Right.
Even the history you live.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's always...
Right. Well, even telling the story of sitting in this room together, you know, I'll be able to tell you what was happening behind you, and you're being able to tell me what's
exactly
happening behind
you. Exactly, yeah.
Right.
Right.
I wanted to ask about your plans to return to Haiti. You mentioned that there is an event that's happening in sort of memorial of the...
The massacre.
Of the massacre, right.
Right. Well, again, stories getting me in trouble. Traveling and talking about the Haitian massacre at one event in New York City in Washington Heights, full of Dominican Americans, and some Haitian Americans were there as well because they got involved in this conversation. I mentioned that one of my dreams is to have some sort of commemoration on the anniversary in October, when the Haitian massacre happened, you know, to have people gather together and sing and poetry and dance as a way to really, give witness,
mm-hmm,
testimony to what happened, but also to say, you know, we the people want to move beyond that because the governments keep, you know, they have their own agendas. And so I mentioned this at one of the readings, saying that, you know, it's always been a dream, but it's such a colossal enterprise with, you know, organizing it, and you need an office, and you need someone to write the grants and funds, forgetting that the young people have all this technology,
mm-hmm,
whereby they put it out on Facebook, they Twitter, they,
right,
create websites. And so these young people in the audience got going. I said, you know, I wanted to be a border of lights. So it's called, there's going to be a website, borderoflights.org.
Yes.
And they're already coming together. And it's going to happen this October 5th and 6th, which is right smack in the middle of the 9 days when the massacre happened. And it's the 75th anniversary of the massacre.
Okay.
So it's going to be quite an event, and I'm going to be there.
Wow.
Just like I told PT.
That's a wonderful,
yes,
thing to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
It'll be amazing.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful because I think what happens is all of our little countries, there's this huge diaspora to this country, and we come here and we come together here.
Right.
You know, as the marginal people, as the outsiders and immigrants, we make friends with each other. Then we take that mentality back home.
Yes.
And we shift the ground. We Yes. The dialogue changes.
Right.
Yep.
Julia, I wanted to ask you about a comment that a friend of yours made after traveling to Brazil. And you mentioned this in the book. She expressed something that you felt about going to Haiti, that it stays with you, that it, I think she said, it stops you in your tracks. And then she said, what then is the obligation?
Right.
Which was very powerful, and I'm wondering if you can talk about your feelings on that.
Well, she had gone to Brazil, and she said, you know, because I was telling her about Haiti, she said, when we have seen a thing, what then is the obligation?
Mm-hmm.
And we're back to seeing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once you see clearly, and you've seen something that moves you and touches you because you've seen past the lenses, you've been at the heart of it, what then is your obligation?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big question. It's a very, you know, 21st century question, because with our access to so much information, where we can be right there and see what's happening in Syria. I mean, we can see the tornado come and take the house away, and we can see people falling, jumping out of buildings,
mm-hmm.
because the Twin Towers are coming down. You know, we see these things. And what then is the obligation? And it just haunted me, that phrase. And I don't, you know, I don't pretend to answer it at all, because one of the writing instructions that I love is from Chekhov, where he says, the task of the writer is not to solve the problem, but to state it correctly.
Mm.
In other words, to see it.
Perfect.
and accurately have the reader see it. You don't have to solve it. In fact, if you solve it, then you start narrowing it down and giving an agenda, you know, a cookie cutter, your agenda, your solution, and you don't liberate the reader.
To take away
and translate into their own ways to solve the problem.
Sure.
You know, so that phrase. And it's funny, you know, people, there used to be like some TV show or radio show, people say the darndest things or something like that.
Wasn't that Art Linkletter?
Oh,
kids say the darndest things.
People say the darndest things.
Yes,
you know?
True.
Bumper stickers. I have this whole little notebook where I jot down the wonderful bumper stickers that people come up with. Yesterday was time to mother Mother Earth. And I thought, that's really cool.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Moonlight in Vermont or starve.
Yeah.
That's the one I always remember.
That's great. So, you know, these phrases sometimes become mantras in your head.
Yes.
When you're writing or when you're experiencing something.
Right, right. I wanted to ask you how Piti is doing now.
Oh, Piti. Piti is over the moon. not because of the book, though it's really cool. He thinks to have a book about his wedding, and he's very excited about that. But I told you, every kid in the world wants to be a rock star, and he has this band. And Bill, who always takes it one step further, decided that if I could write a book about Piti, he could produce a CD.
Right.
So he now has a CD, Piti and Eslina, his wife, and Piti's brother, Adner, and their friend, Eliana, had them tape their music in Jarabacoa, and he brought it back, and with the help of my stepdaughter, who's an artist, Sarah Eichner, she designed the CD cover and the graphics and so forth, and I guess with some online company called Discmakers, they have come out with a CD of Piti's music. And as we've been on the book tour, Bill went with me on part of it, and he was peddling the CDs.
What's the name of the band?
They call themselves what is it that they call them? The first song is "Rise Up, Brothers" in it, and they call themselves the Rise Up Brothers. It's in Creole.
It's in Creole.
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
But and I hesitate because the name has shifted so many times. Because I said, you know, Rise Up Brothers, but two of you are females, you know. So anyhow.
Well, at the end of Write the Book, the show that I am going to, you know, air our conversation on, I will play some of that music.
Music. But anyhow, he's you know, over the moon, because Bill has sold 120 CDs, $10 a piece, And 100% of the proceeds go to Dee and the band.
Wonderful.
So they just are very excited about that.
That's wonderful.
Yes.
That's really exciting.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, before I forget, I want to ask you, who has influenced you as a writer? Who are some of your favorite authors or books?
Well, with this book, because it's a nonfiction book, you know, when I do like to explore new genres, and when I do, you know, I need to learn things because that's not my accustomed genre. And with this nonfiction book, I read a lot of nonfiction, and some favorites are Susan Orleans, who is a wonderful writer, often in The New Yorker, wrote The Orchid Thief, wrote the biography of, the biography, is it of Rin Tin Tin or I think it's Rin Tin Tin, the dog who plays Rin Tin Tin. She's wonderful. She's zany. She's funny. She's soulful. I love her work. So I read a lot of her work. I read an amazing book by Rory Stewart called Places in Between about his walk across Afghanistan. He decided to walk across Afghanistan. Mm. And, you know, it's not just an incredible project, but he's such a wonderful writer. Mm. Bruce Chatwin, the song lines about the Australian Aborigines, a wonderful, wonderful book. Let's see. I've been reading a lot also about aging because of my parents. So I read a wonderful little book by Diana Adhill called Somewhere Towards the End. Mm. I read an excerpt, I think it was in the New York Times magazine, and I was very taken with it. Some of my, I guess, mentors, muses, well, you heard me mention Chekhov. I'm now very taken with writers who can write really powerful novels that are short.
Mm.
I just finished an astonishing novel by Julie Otsuka, The Buddha in the Attic.
Oh, yes, right.
That is a wonderful, wonderful little novel, 129 pages.
Oh.
I love Penelope Fitzgerald, The Blue Flower.
Okay.
I think that's under 200 pages. I'm a big fan of Harriet Dorr, who published her first novel in stories, Stones for Ibarra, when she was 73.
Oh, wow.
She is, you know, a wonderful major writer, died in 2002, I think, at 93 years old, and her reputation, which is sizable, consists of under 600 pages. She wrote three books, starting with the first one when she was 73, and they're wonderful books about an outsider, an American in Mexico, and beautifully.
And are you drawn to the sort of concision of language?
Yes.
And the getting the point across easily and smoothly without a lot of...
It's sort of like I love haikus.
Oh, yeah.
I really love haikus. Often when I do writing workshops, even if they're fiction writing workshops, I have the students do haikus as their finger exercises, taking each sense, take a little snapshot of this thing and that thing and that thing. And it's a way to just really pay attention, to see things,
yes.
to see things. And so I think of short novels as the haiku novels. You know, they're able with really precise details, because when you read The Buddha in the Attic, I think it took her about 8 years to write. And the reading list at the end is almost, you know,
as long as
the book. Any chapter. and you see that she just read, and just really, it's the essence of a novel.
Sure.
And so I admire it, and therefore I would love to be able to do that, because my sensibilities and, you know, my background is Latin, and so I love the Rococo, the Florid, the Faulkner sentences, the many characters, the stories that branch into other stories. But so maybe it's just a case of admiring
the other.
But I would love to try it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, this book is not.
No, that's true.
Not overly long.
I know.
Yeah.
It's
a lovely.
Yeah.
It's just a lovely little gem.
Maybe that's what got me started thinking.
Yeah.
You know, so those are some of the reading that I've been doing lately that I think of as my teachers.
Yes.
You know. Yeah.
Okay. Wonderful. One thing I really admired about A Wedding in Haiti, anytime that you write a memoir, you know, you're exposing something of your own life as well as what other story you might be telling about the larger world. And I really admired your honesty about yourself and your relationship with your husband, mm-hmm. as we talked about before. And one thing that you said in the book was that you used to lie. You used to find yourself telling little fibs without thinking too much about it.
Right.
And that it was a process for you to think about, like, I'm going to change this about myself.
Right, exactly.
So anyway, I loved that you were so honest about yourself in your book. It makes it a more trustworthy piece if
right.
you can read it and feel that the author is looking at themselves, himself, herself,
seeing
more
yourself.
Honestly.
Seeing, you know,
right.
Jeslo Milos has a wonderful poem, Love, that starts, if I don't mess up the lines, something like, to love means to learn to look at yourself the way one looks at distant things, for you are only one thing among many. And whoever sees this way heals his heart without knowing it from various ills. The bird and the tree say to him, friend. But that idea that, is to look at yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, see yourself the way one looks at distant things.
Yeah.
You're only one thing among many. And talking about the word memoir, when we were debating, the editor said, we need a subtitle. People are going to see this and they're going to think it's a novel because they're used to you as a novelist. And I said, as you said, we're going to, how about the subtitle, a memoir? A Wedding in Haiti, a memoir. And I said, no, I don't like that because this is not a memoir. It's not
right.
about just me. I said, let's call it an us-moir, a wedding in Haiti, an us-moir, because it's about all of us. And she said, no one is going to buy a book in a genre that they don't know what it is. So we finally came up with the subtitle, The Story of a Friendship, which is in the title page and not on the cover because it was a late arrival. But again, you know, it's about us.
Yeah.
And I think seeing ourselves as a we can be a very, salutary thing to do.
Yeah.
Not just as
a me.
As a me.
Yeah.
As a me.
Julia, I have one last question for you. Having written A Wedding in Haiti, I'm wondering if you have any advice for other writers who might be trying to write a narrative, maybe a personal narrative or not a personal narrative, either way, that takes place in another culture.
Wow. Well, again, I'm thinking of two books that I did mention because, you know, when you're young and you can, and you're an undergraduate or you're in an MFA program, you have this kind of inbuilt mentoring and musing in your life. Later, if you're lucky, you have some of the friends that you went to workshop with, whom you can exchange work with, or maybe you start a writing group. But your best teachers, I even tell this to undergraduate students, are those masters who are out there who have done it.
Mm.
And you can read the book and get inside of it as a writer and sense the texture and how it's done and the pacing. So I really think to be a writer, you have to be a reader. And when I'm working in a new genre, I do go back and find those books or ask people for recommendations of books and read a lot in that genre to figure out how it works.
Mm-hmm.
So for people that are setting out to write about journeys into other cultures, and I'd say that the most interesting journeys are the ones that aren't occurring just over a landscape.
Mm-hmm.
They're occurring also internally.
Yes.
And in the relationships. They are occurring on many levels. So I would say reading, even their short stories, but they read like a memoir. Stones for Ibarra is
yes.
a wonderful, wonderful book. The one I mentioned by Rory Stewart, The Places in Between, Bruce Chatwin. These
mm-hmm.
are masters. And I think, you know, in order to write about that journey, you've obviously made that journey. Maybe you return to freshen up the details. But keeping a journal,
mm-hmm.
Even if it's a journal, the kind of journal I keep a lot of times on a travel is sometimes lists, you know, just lists. As I'm moving through the landscape, just things that I'm seeing. Or later when Bill and I stop and we're eating or resting, you know, going over it and having him tell me what he saw. And just keeping those things because you think you're going to remember them, but it's like when you wake up at night with a perfect poem.
Right.
you think, oh, I'm so sleepy. I'm not going to forget
I'll
this.
Remember
this is
it.
Such a perfect poem. And the next day it's just gone, you know. So it does help to keep a journal as you travel.
Right. Yep. Write down those things that you see that you're not familiar with from home.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes it's the juxtapositions of one thing and another coming together.
Mm-hmm.
And things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, keeping journals, I mean, it's part of the research, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Julia, I want to thank you so much. Julia Alvarez, thank you so much for speaking with me today. This has been Catalyst. My guest on Catalyst has been Julia Alvarez, author of A Wedding in Haiti, published by Algonquin Books. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Julia Alvarez. As I said, that was a show for RETN as well as for Write the Book at the Radiator. The RETN show is called Catalyst. And you can also watch the interview on television at RETN, which is Channel 16 in Burlington. There are a few different dates that it's going to take place, and you can find all of those on RETN.org. You can also just watch the broadcast as a video on RETN.org. More information about Julia's work is available at her website, JuliaAlvarez.com, and that's spelled J-U-L-I-A, like Julia, which she also goes by, JuliaAlvarez.com. The commemorative event that we discussed during the interview, marking the 75th anniversary of the 1937 Haitian massacre, takes place in the fall, and more information about that event will be available at borderoflights.org. I believe that website is still being built, but there is some information there, and there will be more, I'm sure, as we get closer to the event. Today, I can offer two Write the Book prompts, both of which were generously suggested by my guest, Julia Alvarez. The first is to write a list poem or prose passage. Julia loves making lists, as she said in the interview, and reading them. She wrote in an email to me, "Sometimes when I'm grocery shopping, I'll find a discarded list on a shelf or on the floor, and I always pick it up and read it. Many are just a straight list of items to buy, but every once in a while, the list will include little notes or things to do. I'll start to imagine a story for that shopper who dropped the list." She offered a number of examples of good list poems and prose packages, including this one, which is titled Triad, and it's by 19th century poet Adelaide Crepsey. "These be three silent things, the falling snow, the hour before dawn, the mouth of one just dead." I'll post other examples that Julia sent to me on Write the Book's website, writethebook.podbean.com. She suggests that writers remember that the items on the list need to be vivid and concrete, as sharp as little haikus, because as we read a list, we have to quickly picture each item before the next one comes on board. No brand names, none of those airbrushed abstract adjectives like beautiful or interesting, because those are vague and generic and don't nail down an image with a bright flash of recognition. She writes, "I love the surprises and juxtapositions that happen when you try to group, say, shapely things on a list." That's referring to one of the poems that I'll post on the website. She sent a number of eighth graders wonderful poems from a workshop that she taught, and so those will also be included where I post all these things. Another writing prompt that she suggests comes by way of a book that her stepdaughter, Berit, gave her one Christmas, 6-word memoirs by writers famous and obscure. The book is edited by Smith Magazine, which has a whole website devoted to posts of 6-word memoirs. And that website is smithmag.net/6words. So the second prompt would be, write your 6-word memoir. Julia cautions that it can be really difficult to get the essence of who you are so briefly. So good luck with these prompts, and please listen next week for another. The Bookworm's calendar this week. One big item on the Bookworm's calendar for the week is the grand opening of Phoenix Books in Burlington, which takes place this coming weekend, June 8th through the 10th. And some of the events that will be happening include Local Authors Day, Friday, June 8th, when local authors are invited to come by the store and sign up for their new authors consignment program. June 9th at 4, Madeline M. Cunin reads from her new book, The New Feminist Agenda, Defining the Next Revolution for Women, Work, and Family. I'm looking forward to speaking to Governor Cunin later this week for a future Write the Book show as well. On June 10th from 2 to 4, Andrea Chessman will be at the Phoenix in Burlington presenting her new book, The Pickled Pantry, From Apples to Zucchini, 150 Recipes for Pickles, Relishes, Chutneys, and More. These and other events will take place at Phoenix Books, 191 Bank Street in Burlington, and more information about the store and their grand opening is available at phoenixbooks.biz. And you can tune in later this month for my interview with Michael DeSanto, co-owner of the store. You can check our Facebook page for information about when that interview is going to air. Also happening this week, former Write the Book guest Charlie Nardozzi, author of Northeast Fruit and Vegetable Gardening, will be at Brown Dog Books and Gifts in Hinesburg, Tuesday, June 5th at 7. Donald H. Wickman, historian and author of A Very Fine Appearance, The Vermont Civil War Photographs of George Houghton. Donald Wickman will be at the Milton Historical Society in Milton, Wednesday, June 6th at 7:30. Main Street Landing Performing Arts Center in Burlington presents Sally Fallon Morrell, author of Nourishing Traditions and founding president of the Weston A. Price Foundation, and she will speak on The Oiling of America, the Cholesterol Myths, Thursday, June 7th at 7. And then she's also going to be at Burlington High School on Saturday, June 9th at 9. More information about these events is available at 802-985-0328. Author and VPR commentator Bill Schubart questions what it means to be a Vermonter in a community conversation about his new novel, Panhead. Friday, June 8th at 7:30 at Barnes & Noble in South Burlington. Bill Schubart is a former guest on Write the Book, and he'll be back in later this summer to discuss Panhead with us as well. Gar Alperovitz, author of America Beyond Capitalism, will keynote the Vermont Employee Ownership Conference Friday, June 8th at Champlain College in Burlington. More information about that event is available at veoc.org. Children's book author and illustrator Ashley Wolf reads from Baby Bear Sees Blue before a drawing demonstration Saturday, June 9th from 10:30 to noon at Triangle Park in Middlebury. And there is a rain location, the Vermont Bookshop, if it rains on Saturday. Evelyn Grace Gear, Morristown author of The Lapine Girls of Mud City Embracing Vermont, will be at Bear Pond Books in Stowe on Saturday, June 9th at 11. Author Lung Ung speaks about her latest novel, Lulu in the Sky, A Daughter of Cambodia Finds Love, Healing, and Double Happiness, on Saturday, June 9th at 3. That's at Barnes & Noble in South Burlington. Willard Stern Randall, historian and author, looks at the 1775 invasion of Canada through the eyes of Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold, Sunday, June 10th at 4 at Ethan Allen Homestead in Burlington. So as I mentioned a minute ago, Write the Book does have a Facebook page, and if you're a Facebook user, please like us. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. As always, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, or if you have a writing prompt to suggest, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. And speaking of support, Write the Book is brought to you in part by Main Street Landing, creating places for people to work, play, entertain, meet, eat, and greet on Burlington's waterfront. Main Street Landing rents office and retail space, as well as daily rentals for meetings, events, and performances in their Performing Arts Center. More information is available from Melinda at 802-864-7999 or mainstreetlanding.com. And by Clean Green Sanitation, providing local earth-friendly sanitation services with strong concern for the environment. More information at 802-658-8600 or cleangreen-vt.com. Clean Green Sanitation, keeping it local and keeping it green. And by VCAM, with a mission to enrich civil discourse in the Chittenden County region by providing local citizens with access to training and state-of-the-art digital media tools as a means of personal, political, and artistic self-expression. More info at vermontcam.org. And by Green Candle Theater Company, based in Burlington and dedicated to the production of original theater, the sustainability of the creative economy, and the cultural development of our community. More information about the company and their 20th anniversary production, The Napoleon 2012, May 5th to June 9th, at greencandletheater.com. So as I close out the show, I'm going to play a little bit of music that Julia Alvarez shared with me. This is Bitty's band, Rise Up Brothers. I will on my website also post information about Bitty's band. So this has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont.
Another son of Biblia, baby.